are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, October 26, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks, joining us to look back on the week that was and still is. Ben Dixon from the Benjamin Dixon Show. Also on the program, comedian Ted Alexandro. New special out. Check it out at tedalexandro.com. Maybe we'll talk to him about that. Also on the program, up to 12 bombs and counting sent to demonized non-Republican figures. A suspect is now in custody. A Florida man who, like most false flaggers, came from a van full of pro-Trump posters. Very suspicious. Meanwhile, Trump considers sending troops to the border to guard against wayward piggybacking parents. And also in Florida, Democratic governor candidate Andrew Gillum may win Ben Nelson's Senate seat for him. Meanwhile, the Saudis now admit that the Khashoggi killing was premeditated. Slight reversal from when they said he left the embassy. And finally, regulatory relief for abusive payday lenders, care of Mick Mulvaney's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the Megyn Kelly $69 million experiment has ended. New York State sues Exxon for misleading investors on climate change. And Trump proposes a Rube Goldberg mechanism to achieve the Democratic plan to lower drug costs. And also, he's lying. Meanwhile, Democrats ignoring Trump in campaigns at record levels, while Republicans focus on brown people. And lastly, Brazilian elections this Sunday. The fascist Bolsonaro up by 10%. If you are listening from Brazil, please vote. Otherwise,
good luck.
Keep your fingers crossed. All this and more, ladies and gentlemen, on Casual Friday. Yes, it is the famous Casual Friday here at the Majority Report. One more note on Brazil. Apparently, Lula says, ask Brazil not to go on a fascist adventure. But, you know, we know how alluring that can be.
Super alluring. Also, Noam Chomsky pointed out that Bolsonaro's plans for the Amazon rainforest alone could also be another nail in the coffin of global climate because of the Amazon's distinct role in regulating the global environment.
That would be voting out of fear.
I wish I could do a Portuguese, a Brazilian accent for like Lula was corrupt. I'm not going to vote out of fear.
That's what they'd be voting out of fear.
Yeah. If you get rid of the
Portuguese
Amazon.
Portuguese accent's very tricky.
Yeah, I can't do that one. I like the one with Lenin, which was somebody said, like, so I say he took money from the Germans. I say we get rid of Lenin. We give the power back to the Tsar. We wait for a real revolutionary to come over. Said Jimmy Dore's grandfather.
All right, come on. I don't know why we're getting it so early in the program.
Folks, what are you going to do?
One of today's sponsors is newsvoice.com/majority. You're aware of just how hermetically sealed many of us are The left and the right. The right, of course, are hermetically sealed in a world of news that is, in many times, incredibly fabricated. In fact, most of the show today is about the idea of, like, you know, these two different narratives that seem to exist in the country, and they're competing for each other in terms of electoral. One is we need better health care. The other is that there are throngs of
invaders
of families who, instead of going to out to a family picnic, are going to invade the country and beat us up with pacifiers and stuffies,
which is not good for pre-existing conditions. And the right. Democrats want that.
Right. Exactly.
The Democrats want that.
There's a new media company that has come up with their own response, at least to these problems of the hermetically sealed news bubbles that people are in. Not so much the other problems, but maybe one will help the other. It's called News Voice. It's an app for iOS and Android. It gives you access for free. I'm sorry, you can get access for free for this app if you go to newsvoice.com/majority. It gives you a personalized news feed by aggregating a mix of mainstream media sources, international sources, and independent media sources. Multiple sources are provided for each news story. So in my mind, that's the best thing about this service, is that if you want to have arguments with people about stuff, it's very important to know what they are, what they're sort of starting point, their basic assumptions are. The entire app is fueled by crowdsourcing. You can upvote stories you think are important so more people will see them. You can add stories to the app. You can add a source that's missing to the story. It's meant to be completely open and a democratized news aggregator. Like I say, lets you get every side of every story. They also have video interviews, a series featuring guests from Chris Hedges to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Go download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. If you are listening to this program, we have it in the podcast description. If you're watching this program, it's in our YouTube description. Check it out, newsvoice.com/majority. All right, so today we're going to be talking about this with Ben Dixon. Broadly speaking, we are now, 10 days out from the election? I can't do the math. A week from Tuesday. And obviously, super important to get out there to tell people to vote. My basic assumption is that 99.9% of you who are listening to the sound of my voice are planning to vote. So I'm not going to waste my time imploring you to vote. I am going to waste my time imploring you to get other people to vote. Find, by any means necessary, those people who you think are not voting and have them vote. Super, super important. Even if you think you're in a safe district, the sheer numbers will help the narrative, and that's also important. That's what a big part of politics is. And it's, you go out there and you vote, you get people involved. Who knows where it goes from there? So go out, meet some people, talk to some people. Maybe you will create relationships that will be helpful 2 weeks from now when you start agitating for the winners of these elections to do what you want them to do, which is ultimately just as, if not more important. Well, probably more important, but obviously one is subsidiary to the other. They have to be in office for you to be able to agitate to them to get them to do what you want. So here is Donald Trump. He is in Wisconsin. Wisconsin reportedly has purged their rolls of hundreds of thousands of voters. Certainly no, in the run-up to the 2016 election, they had practiced a finely tuned form of voter suppression. They have a strict voter ID, which targets African-Americans and students, at least at the top of the list. Donald Trump is there campaigning for Scott Walker, who is in big trouble. He predicted at the beginning of this year he would be in big trouble. Hopefully he loses badly. But Donald Trump here lays out what Republicans, and we're going to play other clips from people who are pundits, to people who are candidates. And Donald Trump here is just laying the groundwork. You will hear this is obviously the message that Republicans are running on, which is be afraid of brown people and let me come up with multiple different ways of trying to express it. So if you're not afraid of brown people because of this small anecdote, you're going to be afraid of brown people for that anecdote. And then, of course, Trump adds his own sort of, I want to say hyperbole, but it's really just complete lying in presenting this case.
It's tough stuff. And, you know, where I grew up near Long Island, we have like these great communities and they were infiltrated with MS-13. And we got them. He says, get them the hell out. We are, actually. We actually are. We are getting them out of this country by the thousands, if you can believe it. But, you know, it's like liberating, like a war, like there's a foreign invasion and they occupy your country and then you get them out through whatever and they call it liberation. You're liberated. ICE goes in and they're much tougher, much stronger and much smarter. They go in and they, in a relatively nice way, I want to say that, relatively nice, they get them out. They put them in the paddy wagons and they get them out of the country. They bring them back home. Or worse.
Pause it. Or worse. Or worse. The percentage of members of MS-13 that ICE has arrested in the 2 years of the Trump administration, we don't know exactly because I don't know if they released these type of data. But it can't be anything just by sheer numbers, unless there were hundreds of thousands of members of MS-13 in this country. It can't be more than a couple of percentage points. ICE is far more adept under the Trump administration of rounding up and deporting moms and dads of middle-class families, people who have been here for an extended period of time. I mean, this is all obviously a lie, but that is just, you got to start, like, you know, you got to think about this as like steps, right? You can't get to the top step in terms of like incredible lies unless you go through these subsidiary steps. And so and now he's taking us to stuff that, like, honestly, the idea that grown people, I understand motivated reasoning, but the idea that grown people don't get up and walk out and go like, this is just too much. What if somebody sees me here at this point after this lie is, I blows my mind.
Or worse. And these towns are being liberated and the people are clapping. They're looking, I'm telling you, it's like watching World War II movies. It's like watching documentaries on World War I and World War II, the occupations. They get them, they take them out, and the people are on their windows. They're clapping and screaming, and they're happy. This is ICE. And the Democrats want to terminate ICE. They want to get rid of them.
Pause it. Is there anybody in the audience who's just going like, well, maybe he's exaggerating a little. Maybe there aren't people.
Wouldn't we be the people that would have seen that footage?
But you know what I think partially what's going on, though, and this doesn't in any way undermine your point, is the I forget who first came up with the phrase, but taking Trump seriously but not literally. And I think there's a lot of like, for all intents and purposes, if you're this xenophobic and bigoted in your voting, in it might as well be, right?
Right.
Like MS-13 is the same thing.
Well, of course they can't do that in their windows because there's too much PC-ness. But inside, they close the drapes and then they're cheering out their windows.
So I think he's actually, so it's a funny way, I think he's actually saying, like, they're basically saying, like, it's all the same to me. And here's like a touch of ridiculous nonsense conspiracy theory.
I know it's the exact same sort of lie, but just flipped, as he said when he said Muslims were celebrating 9/11.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's exactly
inside it. Inside they were. Inside it, themselves.
Literally. I think that's exactly what's going on.
They want to get rid of them. So if you want to uphold our laws, our borders, and our way of life, You need to vote for Scott Walker and Leah Vukmar. Leah Vukmar.
Jesus.
He's so funny.
I'm so impressed that I got her name right. Vukmar. That is, you know why he said that, right? Because phonetically, that's the way it's spelled out on his teleprompter.
Vukmar. How is he not crazy? Like, how is he not like a professional Liberace impersonator?
It's crazy.
Like, how is this not like?
He kind of is.
He is basically a I'm a really racist professional Liberace impersonator
with the maturity of a teenager.
Less than.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Ben Dixon from The Benjamin Dixon Show. We are back. Sam Seder on The Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the proprietor and host of the Benjamin Dixon Show, available on iTunes and Stitcher and at the BenjaminDixonShow.com. Benjamin Dixon. Hello, Ben.
Sam.
How are you?
I'm doing great, Sam. Always a pleasure to be here with you all. How's it going over there?
It's going great.
Rather.
thank you so much for joining us. Let's just briefly talk about this. I mean, it's sort of, I don't know, maybe on some level, I feel like I'm not doing my job as a polemicist and as a sort of, propagandist in the most sort of value neutral expression. But there have been 12 bombs now sent to Democratic leaders. And you know, one guy associated with, and a couple of like, administrative people like Brennan and, Holder.
Right.
I don't know why these bombs didn't go off. I'm not a bomb maker or a bomb diffuser. But they could have, and maybe those people wouldn't have been killed, but it would have been other, people. But the idea of, like, bombs being sent to the top leadership of the opposition party seems a little problematic, and you would imagine that, like, everything would stop, right?
Yeah.
And right. They have found the guy. Here is a picture of his van. It is adorned with pictures of Pence and Trump and pictures of like Michael Moore with a target on it, Hillary Clinton with a target on it, Jill Stein with a target on it, others. And I mean, and now I don't know, maybe it's all false flag. Maybe when they get in there, it's going to be, Tom Perez is going to be, that's his van and whatever, but highly unlikely. just give me your sense of how underplayed this is. And like the idea that Donald Trump, you would think that Donald Trump would like say, call the former president and say, hey, just want you to know we're doing everything we can to protect you.
Yeah. that's the most, one of the most notable things outside of the insanity of bombs being sent itself. I feel like you, like I gave the same disclaimer on my podcast this morning. Like I mentioned it, but I didn't want to stay there because there's just too many variables there that we don't know, except for the ridiculousness that we're getting from Donald Trump and the conservatives. This perfectly sealed hermetic bubble that they exist in, they have accepted in their minds, even the president, he's floating this idea that it's a false flag. That's clearly a possibility, but to have that spread by the president before the FBI can actually resolve that is the case just shows you just how ridiculous, I mean, how far gone we are, to the point where that behavior by Trump is the exact same thing that drives our news cycle, that is just constantly day after day. We can't even keep up with it. So now that 12 bombs have been sent, or packages that are suspected of being bombs or whatever they are, it's not, nothing shut down. Nobody's moving any slower. The news is still going just as fast as ever.
But I mean, let's talk about this notion of people floating that it's a false flag, right? Like, mm-hmm. like I think I saw that guy, Brett Weinstein, you know, making some argument about like it would be irresponsible, like because it's a possibility, the idea of raising this question shouldn't be criticized in some way.
Right.
And
right.
I do not remember a single instance when any of these people, when anybody ever said it was a false, like hypothesized that it could be a false flag when we had any other type of like the Times Square right. bombing or any right. of this other stuff. Because I mean, let's be honest here. It is a possibility that it's a false flag in the same way that it's a possibility that it's a false flag of a false flag of a false flag of a false flag of a false flag.
Exactly.
Like the idea that someone's going to send out 12 bombs and it's some type of democratic operative, okay?
Right.
And right. They're going to send this out and not get caught, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're so good at this that they can send out 12 bomb packages and not get caught is highly, highly unlikely, it seems to me. Like beyond unlikely, it is almost to the level of absurdness. Now, it's possible
yeah.
you could have a crazy person who sends this, who is like, I'm supportive of all these people, and therefore I'm sending it, and I won't get caught, and they're completely crazy. But it's not really a false flag as much as mm-hmm. it is. It's a crazy person who has been driven to do something crazy. And,
right.
You know, no doubt this guy has some mental issues if it's a guy who sent these mm-hmm. out. But this is like, you know, there are certain the idea of entertaining this as a false flag, like it's an operation, right? Like there's
right.
some is just absurd. And it is, I don't know. To me, that's just, it's absurd.
It's to be expected from certain circles like Dinesh D'Souza. This is right par and course. This is how he makes his money, right? To have it coming from the White House. I don't care if Donald Trump is the president. I don't care how ridiculous Donald Trump is. To have that coming from the White House absolutely undermines the entire process, right? And I'm not surprised that Donald Trump is doing this, but we still can't like let that be an excuse for how absurd this is. At some point, we have to grab hold of one of these news cycles and not just be flung around with the madness all day and cling on to the fact that this is happening right before our eyes and it's being spearheaded by the president of the United States. I think one of the reasons we can't make anything stick to Donald Trump is because we're spinning so fast and he knows that and he's contributing to that. And I think that's why he floated the false flag notion this morning. And I don't know if it's this morning or last night, but when he floated it, he knows what he's contributing to. He's contributing to the chaos.
Let's listen to this clip from what's her name? Trish Regan, she is on Fox Business, and she has an interesting take as to what caused this this situation with these bombs, but also sort of like, you know, there's a chyron underneath that the breaking news U.S. troops are deploying to the border because, Ben, as you know, and I'm sure you know, you are, I believe, down in the Atlanta area, so you are south of us. And I mm-hmm. imagine this makes this that much more harrowing for you. But approximately 2,000 miles from you, there are almost 2,500 families with children who
terrifying
who are obviously looking to take over your home. So, but let's listen to Trish Regan break this down for us.
Tonight. Plus, new tonight, a nationwide manhunt underway for the suspected mail bomber. We have fresh intel that Florida, Maryland, and New York are key areas of interest. Meanwhile, the media is ratcheting up its attacks on the president, saying these heinous acts are all his fault. The media refusing to take any responsibility for themselves. It's the victim mentality all over again. Geraldo is here, and he is my guest on that.
Geraldo.
Right. Yeah. Well, which part of that is the most absurd? The idea that
the Geraldo part, hands down, like he's going to be the expert on this issue. But no, seriously, the entire framing is asinine, Sam. I don't even know what you want to say about that.
Well, I mean, CNN's taking a victim mentality probably because they had two bombs sent to them.
I mean, there's that. There's that. Here's the bigger problem that you speak to all the time. And I always like to cast it in this framing, right? This is strategic. This is not an oversight. This is part of the programming. It's not a bug. It's a feature. They know what they're doing. It's the victimizers playing the role of the victim. It's calling the real victims people who are having the victim complex. It's the oppressor trying to maintain power by feigning as though they are the oppressed. And anytime they can find a scapegoat that they can fulfill that victim complex that they are projecting onto us through right now, it's the migrants that are coming north. They execute it flawlessly, and they do so. Here's the biggest problem. They do so through this massive propaganda machine that is funded by billionaires that we don't have anything remotely close to on the left. And that combination makes them successful over and over again. We felt like we had one step forward, I guess, you know, with Obama. But now it really feels like we've taken 10 steps back. That's because we never really took a step forward. We just kind of had an anomaly. But this conservative machine that is able to project this victimhood, this victim complex that they are operating in, they've been doing this masterfully for years. So this is just an extension of that.
You know, there's along those lines, there's a new book out, and I think we're going to have one of the authors on. But it's nothing, you know, it's not huge news to you or I, or probably to most of the people who listen to this program. I mean, certainly there has been advances since 2004 and in the early aughts. But professor at Harvard Law School has written a book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics, basically saying that, if you had removed Rupert Murdoch from the equation 25 years ago, the world would be a much nicer place. And yeah. So I guess maybe that's, folks' goal. You know, you want to have impact on the world. And if you can't do it, as long as you're a superlative, it doesn't really matter which way it goes. But just to your point about what, as we sort of pivot to look at the elections that are, now about 11 days away, here is a clip of Martha McSally, which I think, and this is taken from, I think they played it on MSNBC, on maybe on Morning Joe, but it's a local news coverage of the Arizona Senate race. Martha McSally is running against Kristen Sinema, not necessarily my favorite candidate of the Democratic field, but it's better than John McCain or Jeff Flake. But here is Martha McSally. This clip captures the dynamic of what's going on in the country right now in terms of the races. There was a report out by the Wesleyan Media Studies Group that showed that Democrats paid advertising, at least, which is the easiest thing to measure, uses the word or reference to Trump less than any political party has in a midterm election in 15 to 20 years. Wow. And on top of that, they have found that that Republicans are using immigration more than they have in also similar period of time. And here is that that dynamic distilled in a series of quick sound bites from Martha McSally as she's being questioned by a local reporter in Arizona.
Will you fight to retain pre-existing conditions as they are today?
Brom, I have fought for pre-existing conditions. I voted to protect pre-existing conditions.
You voted for something that would weaken pre-existing conditions. You voted for something that would weaken pre-existing conditions.
Right now, Brom, it's not true.
And then
that, you know, press release comes out on something that's processy, and you guys are asking me about it in this top race in the country. It's just ridiculous. Well, can we talk about economic opportunity?
Do you know if any of your staff is getting their health care through the ACA?
Dennis, can we please talk about the things that matter to most voters instead of repeating the Arizona Democrat Party press releases? I mean, this is
ridiculous.
From the party.
It's ridiculous, honestly. Do you have anything to talk about, like the caravan?
There you go. Do you have anything to talk about, like the caravan, the thing that's on people's minds? I mean, it's amazing.
That's staggering. I mean, you know, that she can get away with that. There has to be a new style of journalism, or maybe just a harken back to other ages of journalism, maybe, because you can't let them get away with that. I mean, don't get me wrong. When a politician is intent on weaseling their way out, there's almost nothing that you can do, but you can really expose the fact that they are weaseling their way out. I don't know how the rest of that clip played out, but that attempt to pivot was so transparent that it should have been caught on the fly. And that's really the only way we're going to be able to hold these people accountable. But to the bigger point, I mean, the fact that Republicans are running on the dog whistle and the bullhorn of racism and xenophobia, and the fact that Democrats are timid about attaching this to Donald Trump. I mean, I don't know. Is it possible for them to really be this genuinely incompetent? Sam, I'm asking that question. Help me out here.
Well, all right. Let me address that. Let me address that second. First, okay. I will say, like, these local reporters, they were hounding her about the pre-existing conditions. And I thought they were doing a pretty good job. It's almost that the problem is that we know what she's talking about when she says the caravan. Right. Like the problem has been all of the coverage where people were sending people down to the caravan, because that is it, to me, it's the functional equivalent of a meteorology report that is focusing on a rainstorm that is, you know, off the coast of Hawaii, and it may implicate, you know, California. Okay. I mean, it's so irrelevant. The story really is Donald Trump seems to be focusing on something that's completely irrelevant. And we shouldn't even know. We shouldn't be able to know what she's talking about when she says the caravan. But the second part, I think, like, I don't know. I think there are Democrats who are perennially afraid of racializing things. And on some level, that's what's sort of fascinating about what's going on in Florida, to pivot to that, because I think everybody's seen the clip. We certainly played it yesterday. And it has been really viral, where Andrew Gillum is the Democratic nominee for governor, and he's running against Ron DeSantis. And we should just say, as a backstory, Gillum was not expected to win the Democratic primary.
Right.
There was, I can't remember her name now. It's been, there's somebody, but he was not expected to win. He had a late surge. And he is the most progressive candidate of that Democratic primary field. He wins. He's African-American, if people have not seen this clip or are not familiar with him. And DeSantis is, you know, there are Republicans like this. Like, you know, in New York, we had that guy, Carl, what was his name? Pavlon, or I can't remember, Palumbo, who, you know, was famous for sending around Obama as a Kenyan faxes and ran for governor in the state. But DeSantis is like that, but was, you know, people thought he was going to win, and he still may, but it's highly in doubt. And Gillum basically just went right at him for his racism and said something that I thought was really brilliant. He said, "I'm not calling you racist. I'm just saying the racists seem to think you are." And that's a brilliant construction, I think.
Yeah.
That go ahead.
You don't recognize that, though, do you? It's totally from The Simpsons, Fox News, not racist, but number one with racist. And when I heard him say it, I was like, you know, that is a brilliant use of that meme that's been going around. But I was surprised that he went head on into it for the same reason that you outlined in your setup, because, you know, there's a lot of Democrats who are really afraid of doing that.
And I mean, what's also interesting about this race in Florida is that if Gillum wins, he's winning he was an improbable winner in the primary, and he's running in a way that is embracing a very progressive values in a genuine swing state. This is a state that went for Obama big in 2008, went for Obama not so big in 2012. It more or less flipped by a couple hundred thousand votes for Trump versus Clinton. And if Gillum wins in the swing state, he's basically going to drag Bill Nelson across the finish line, too, it seems like.
Yes. Yes. And that's so critical. Like I'm from Florida. One of the states I'm from is Florida. I lived there through high school and most of college. And I'm just encouraging everyone, if you're going out to vote for Gillum, I think the last poll I saw, he was up by 7 or 8 points.
Been a couple. I've seen 3. I've seen 9. I've seen 7. But he seems to be up.
He's going to be the one to carry Bill Nelson. So I'm imploring them, please. We don't need Rick Scott of the last person. Like, we don't need any Republican, but Rick Scott, who's thrown $52 million of his own personal money because he's made that money off of Medicare fraud. I mean, for him to be able to go to the Senate would be obscene. But Bill Nelson is in a tough fight there. So you're absolutely right. Gillum would be bringing the more centrist, the more senior establishment Democrat, pulling him over the hurdle, which we absolutely need right now, because the last thing we need is Rick Scott to take a Democratic seat and turn it red.
And the implications, though, of that dynamic, right, where you have someone who is young, African-American, unabashedly progressive, basically carrying this old white guy centrist across the finish line in a genuine swing state, to me, is has huge implications. I mean, there are other races, obviously, we want to win, but this one seems to have like big implications as to what forms the narrative within the Democratic Party as to where you need to go to win.
Yeah. It's critical. I think in a way it's going to be far more significant than Ocasio-Cortez. Not that we have to make a comparison, but Ocasio-Cortez was kind of like the flashpoint where we realized, wow, there's going to be a new generation of Democratic leadership across the country. But now we're seeing it play out in a very substantive fashion, in a very difficult state, like you said, a swing state, in a race that the first place I ever got called the N-word was Florida. I mean, I'm telling
congratulations
you,
congratulations on that.
Yeah, it's an achievement, right? It's North Florida is the South. It is the legitimate South, and that that Gillum is able to call out this racism so directly, and I don't think he's gone down on the polls yet. I haven't looked at him this morning. It really speaks to where we have to go. I mean, it's not Nelson. It's not Nelson who's, put it like this, Joe Biden, who is looking for some type of way for us to get past the incivility. That is not the person and the brand that's going to be able to take us into this next fight.
Yep.
And we're seeing that similarly play out in Florida.
I know that the Republicans are not as afraid of Joe Biden as they pretend to be, because Charlie Kirk told me they were. And I know that. I'm quite convinced that.
Can I ask you something? Does it not frustrate you that a scumbag and moron like Charlie Kirk is even put on the same stage as you? I mentioned this on my show a couple weeks ago, and I was like, I'm going to ask him about it. And you just reminded me for bringing him. I mean, the guy doesn't really know anything. He simply has millions of dollars behind him, which is completely reflective of the thing that we always talk about, media and money. Conservative money in media just making stars, like, you know, not that it's important, but it frustrated me for you.
I mean, look, I feel like I have a job to do. And, you know, I think you certainly, you know, more than most people can understand. It's like you have a certain skill set. And, you know, I would have liked to have been, you know, a better student, maybe, and maybe be in a more, you know, had or the capacity to have more academic pursuits. But these are the skill sets I have at this point in my life. And if I can go and in any way inhibit the trajectory of any of these people, I am more than happy to do it. frankly. Yeah. I mean, so.
Well, you did that. That you did. But yeah, it was just the fact that this guy from nowhere gets some millions of dollars from some donors and instantly is inserted into the national conversation for the purposes of propaganda is like, it's like our life story right now. Like, it's happening over and over again all around the country.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think about it that way. I don't feel like, you know, I don't know who else I would go, you know, be on a stage with. I mean, I think like if they want to do some type of academic debate with good faith people, I think there are people who are better suited for that than I. But I think I'm pretty well suited to go up on stage with somebody who's not a good faith actor and is and if, you know, I mean, that's.
So you're the man. You're, if they're going to put these morons up there, you're the man to take them out.
I sort of feel like that is, you know, for better or for worse, you know, I think I was probably genetically engineered for two things. One, fairly lame sitcoms to play the lead who is put upon. And when that sort of ran its course, then I think this was the next thing for me to do. But, all right, well, listen, let me ask you this. Just sticking with Florida for one more minute. The interesting thing, too, about Gillum is, I mean, this is why this race to me is so fascinating, has so much importance. In addition to what we've already said about the narrative that it sets for the Democratic Party, this is also like the ability for Gillum to impact the electorate of Florida is also super huge, right? Like, you know, he's going to have the ability to enfranchise like literally tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people. This to me is huge because so often we see, and we should also say simultaneously, there's an amendment for which would basically, you know, re-enfranchise like 1.5 million voters, people who had been convicted of a felony in Florida. And you know, right now, Rick Scott's been doing it literally handpicking the voters, you know. But Gillum's going to impact that amendment as well, right? And vice versa. So like turnout's going to be fascinating. The exit polls from Florida are going to be fascinating and the implications of him winning are going to be huge. But you're in Georgia. What's going on there?
Stacey Abrams, I think she's up by 2 points, which means that she's not up. We're going to knock on doors. My friend Anoa Changa, she's really active here. We're going to knock on doors on Sunday for her, just because the turnout is so critical, especially when you have this Secretary of State running for governor who has the ability and is utilizing that ability to disenfranchise so many people, purging voters across the state, particularly in black counties. We're seeing it over and over again. The ACLU, we got a quick win this week. Well, not a quick, but an important win this week with the ACLU determining that individual poll workers cannot reject signatures, ballots, because they've made an individual call. And in the case that they do reject ballots, they have to contact the person. This was the craziest part about this, Sam, was that they could reject your ballot and not notify you. Now they have to notify you in this upcoming election. So there's some critical wins that ACLU has been in the front of that are going to make the difference. But still, like, no one is even batting the eye that we have a Secretary of State Republican running for governor who's creating this situation in the first place. And everyone is still acting as though he's a good faith actor. And I guess I'm just not sure how those two things can coexist when you literally see him targeting communities of color in this race.
Is there anybody there talking about like, hey, this would be a good thing to do regardless of who wins, to reform this in some way, like have the concept of recusal in certain instances or something to that effect?
You know, I think it's going to take a Democrat doing this for them to actually say, OK, we want to put an end to this, because previously you've had other secretaries of state run for governor here in the state. And then generally have been Republican, if my memory serves me correctly. So no. But that kind of goes back to that questionable fecklessness that we occasionally see from Democrats, because that should be something that happens every, you know, even if they're not in power. That has to be a war drum that they beat, because we go through this. You know, Georgia has gone through this many times, apparently.
Is there do you have any sense that that there's been a good enough job in talking about the voter suppression to drive votes? Like, there have been occasions. Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I notice it. So I do this thing now where I go to church now, which is different. But they're talking about it all the time in church, in churches. Like, I'm hearing it everywhere in like the barbershops. So this is having the reverse effect. It's like, you want to take this from us, we're going to show up and make sure that you don't take it from us. So that's a net positive. But, you know, these are all anecdotes. Is it actually going to be a number significant enough to overcome the purge? I don't know.
All right. Let's briefly just talk about Megyn Kelly for a minute. Okay. I mean, I know I've seen you on Twitter with this stuff, and, you know, I think there's been, you know, I think people can go on Twitter and see that you've been getting into it a little bit with Cenk Uygur, who didn't think that Megyn Kelly should be fired for her latest, insistence that it was okay for blackface. I mean, let's just start with let's start with the blackface question just more generally. I mean, from my perspective, like, I've gone on TV and I have said, I remember going on TV one time and saying, you know, I can't remember what context, but I was saying somebody had gone off the reservation, and people on Twitter, you know, were like, dude, you got to start thinking about what you're saying, because, and I, you know, I grew up using that. It was just a vernacular, you know, it was a colloquialism. Right. And then when you start thinking about it, like, you realize, like, you know what? I can understand why that would be pretty offensive to people, that, you know, the idea that a group of people were sequestered so that we could steal their land and told you can't go off of the reservation. And if you do, and somehow it's like, as opposed to like you're liberating yourself or you're taking it is somehow you're doing something wrong. And so I stopped using it. But I also think that, like, I didn't have a history of maligning Native Americans. And so people were, you know, okay. They were satisfied that I had learned my lesson. Right. Is it possible for anybody to take that position with Megyn Kelly? I mean, let's just put aside for a moment that it was clear somebody made a very, very bad professional bet on Megyn Kelly. Okay. They made a very bad bet, and it was a very expensive bad bet. And they were looking for any reason to get rid of her that could make it seem like it wasn't a function of them making a bad bet. Okay. Right. So putting that aside for a moment, because then the question is, do you give Megyn Kelly the benefit of the doubt? Who could possibly give Megyn Kelly the benefit of the doubt, and why?
You know, that's what made me so upset about Cenk's segment, because he framed it in the sense that it was that she just maybe don't know. People don't know. And the thing is like, if you don't know and you want to imitate a black person, you don't go get Tar Baby Black coal and put on your face, because that is a direct hearkening back to Jim Crow, to the Klan using it in their movies and Birth of a Nation. That's the imitation, the insulting of black people with this tar baby. If you want to look black, you get a brown hue. And I'm making that distinction because ignorance would tell you that if I want to look black, I'm going to put on a brown face. This is not done in ignorance. This is done intentionally to irritate, to racially irritate the black community. Now, we've insulated ourselves from it to a certain extent, where it's like, we expect this because every Halloween we have this conversation. So not only do I not extend this grace to Megyn Kelly, and neither should have Cenk Uygur, but I don't extend this to anybody, because you had to research blackface for you to say, oh, I'm going to get this tar baby black color instead of a brown pigmentation, which most African Americans in America are brown versus a true black. You had to have done that. And once you come across it, you make a conscious decision. And this, Sam, mind you, is going underneath the grace of ignorance. We're giving them, extending them the grace of saying they're ignorant about it. When you come out of your house and your home and you're tar baby black with white lips, you are intentionally going back to an era of Jim Crow, and you're doing it for the purposes of, I don't know, Well, I don't. Is your show on radio? Because I don't want to cuss if it is.
No, you can. At this point, who cares about
you? You're doing it for shits and giggles. You're right. Literally doing it for shits and giggles. The Trayvon Martin murder, you know, one of the first images that are still being circulated right now is a guy in blackface, tar baby blackface with a hoodie on, with Skittles, with a Arizona iced tea, and with a bullet wound in his chest. This is never done in ignorance. It's done intentionally. And Megyn Kelly, above all people, who made sure that she reassured the children who are watching Fox News that Jesus was white and Santa Claus was white. I mean, she is well aware. She's 50 something years old. She's paid $23 million a year. She's going to walk away with $69 million a year. She is not ignorant. And to infantilize her in that way in order to insulate her from criticism or being fired is not something that a progressive leader of the independent media should be engaged in. I like Cenk. I actually tried to get on the Young Turks when I first got in this game. I mean, who else was I going to try to get on their show with? But come on, man. He knows this. And I don't get it. I honestly don't get his move on this one.
I mean, all right. Well, I mean, putting aside, what Cenk was thinking, I think just the idea that, like, look, if you're going to go on television, you know, and this is almost distinct from race. I mean, broader than race. If you're going to be on television, And you know, some people are defending or saying, like, well, why can't we have a conversation about race? It's like, well, if you're going to talk about something that is clearly a sensitive topic and very important to society, you have a responsibility to do a certain amount of research. So, I mean, like, even if she was to say, like, look, I'm a little bit ignorant about this. Well, then, you know what? You're really, really almost criminally bad at your job. And you should be fired, and you should give back all the money that you're earning, because you should be so embarrassed that as a professional, you would go on without researching the implications of blackface in American history. Right. I mean, you know, to clarify, like you're saying, like, if people are going out for Halloween, right, people who are not on television promoting something, but they're just going out for Halloween, like, I don't know. I feel like you could go out, right, as a Holocaust victim. And Jesus. And people would be sort of like, I think, right to be like a little offended. Like, hey, man, not funny or cute. Like, what's going on there? Like, and, you know, to go as, like, you know, like, to me, it seems like the same thing. And it's not like, you know, if you go as a Holocaust victim, it's very specific. If you're going,
it's too specific to not have been researched. Like, you thought, you put some thought into this, and you had to have known that this is going to ruffle some feathers. And Sam, I don't mean to cut you off, but that's literally the point. The point of blackface and all of these insulting costumes generally. I mean, of course, you do have examples of people who just clueless, but we're not talking about clueless items. We're talking about people who picked something that is most certainly offensive, no matter how you cut it. They put thought into it. And this is the point. The brutality is the point. And that's what makes this so insidious.
All right. Well, let's say I'm going out as Idris Elba, or however you pronounce that guy who should be Bond, that guy, right? And I put on like bronzer. Where am I on that spectrum?
You're on the spectrum like, Sam, what are you doing? Just go wash that off and put on the nicest suit that you can, shave your hair and take off your glasses and just say that you're Idris Elba. Let's just call it a day. Right. You know?
Right. Like or just go as like, I'm the white Idris Elba or whatever. Yes. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but the guy who should be Bond. The guy who should be the next Bond.
Listen, there's this imitation that is flattery, but then there's imitation that is mockery. And that's what blackface has always been. There's never been an example. And the fact that that the onus is being placed on black people time and time and time and time and time and damn time again for us to do the education, even of people who are making millions of dollars to do the education, is the part of this equation that's so infuriating. Like, no, you did the research to figure out which hue of black you want to go with, you should do the research on your own and pay the consequence for why this was such a bad idea.
And we should say, like, you know, people are very comfortable with certain things being taken off the table in polite society.
Yeah. Come
right?
on.
Like you can't go on television as a host of a show and, you know, just on multiple occasions, burp in the middle of what you're doing or, you know, or fart. And, you know, on one hand, you know, you could be like, well, man, it's the human body. And why not, you know, why are we pretending like this doesn't happen? And it's really offensive. Like, I can come up with the exact same, because this expands into, like, you know, how certain comedians can't go on college campuses and deliver certain jokes in some way. Maybe I'm teasing Ted Alexandro a little bit, you know, appearance in a minute. But this concept of, like, really what we're going through, it seems to me, and this dynamic, I think, explains our political moment as much as anything, you know, obviously for broader issues. But the idea that, like, essentially that black people, now they get to have their say in what might be offensive too.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's one step too far for some people.
I mean, I think that's basically the era, and not just black people, obviously, but trans folks, women, people of color generally. I mean, folks who have been more marginal and disempowered in our society since the beginning now have a little bit of power, and they get to say what they also think is offensive.
Sam, if I got on my show, as small as my show is, and I drop the F word, not F-U-C-K, but the homophobic slur. If I drop that, there is not going to be a single person in my audience, and rightfully so, who's going to say, well, let's have a conversation about it and let's educate Ben, because let's make sure that this guy who talks politics all day long and gets paid the coins that I get paid, that I need to be educated about it and that we need more speech, not less speech. No, we have rightfully determined that there are certain things that are not acceptable. And if you call that being politically correct, I just call it not being a dick. There's no reason for us to do these things when they have been clearly demarcated as a bridge too far for people that you, in the progressive side of the equation, are supposed to be allies. Why are we even having this conversation on the progressive side of the conversation? I understand Megyn Kelly. I understand her trying to play this game. That's what she did at Fox. What I don't understand, and I, you know, he's cool, I like him, but I don't understand Cenk supporting this.
Yeah, I mean, and to me, like, the conversation, just broadly speaking, has value because we understand also, I think, like, you know, what people who watch Megyn Kelly, to the extent that there are anybody left, who watch Megyn Kelly, you know, what they're thinking about and, like, sort of what these complaints are, because it does. You know, I can't explain what Cenk's reasoning is there, but that to me is less relevant than what it sort of, like, this broader political time, I think, is so much about this. Like, you know, basically a large portion of the white people in this country, you know, just resenting.
Get off on this.
Resenting that, you know, non-white males get to choose what is impolite when it's always been white males who get to choose their parameters as to what's impolite.
Right. I got hip to this, and I know we probably have to get out of here. I got hip to this the day after Hillary Clinton lost. I was scheduled to be at a Tea Party debate. I took it because why not? In Massachusetts. I was right around the corner. So I went, Worcester. And at that
Dude,
rally,
in Worcester? Sweet.
I came to grips with the reality that this is the point. The brutality is the point. 2 years ago, when the moderator was describing Donald Trump's slurs of Elizabeth Warren and the Pocahontas and all these types of things, the guy who was debating against me said, "Oh no, that's the part I like. I'm glad he does that. I'm not embarrassed by it." You know, this was really, really the point. There's a big part of our population that enjoys this. And if we don't recognize that, we'll always be playing this game of trying to understand them. The only thing you need to understand is that this is what they enjoy.
Ben Dixon, The Benjamin Dixon Show. People can find it at thebenjamindixonshow.com, or you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you find podcasts are disseminated. Ben, thanks so much. I really appreciate it, buddy.
Hey, it's always a pleasure. Talk to you again.
All right, bye-bye. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Oh, geez, we're running late. And when we come back, Ted Alexandra. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. We will have more to say about this later in the program. Apparently, this guy has threatened folks in this office. But the
hilarious,
super funny stuff. But the MAGA bomber, allegedly, they have a suspect who is allegedly the MAGA bomber. His name is Cesar Sayoc Jr. He was apparently a Trump rally celebrity. He has an arrest history in Minnesota and criminal records in New York and Florida. He was traced by DNA evidence, and we will have more on that in the program later. And apparently he... threaten some people in this office. So, with that said, let's have our top billing for the night. That was our opening act. And now I would like to welcome to the program Ted Alexandro. How's that, Ted? How's that?
That's not the first time that I've had somebody bombing open for me.
Nice. Well done.
That?
Talk about a pro, folks. So, Ted, you're on the road, and let's just start with this. And I just tell people you can get more information at TedAlexandro.com, and we're going to talk about your special, which has been released. I think it was released a couple of weeks ago. I want to talk about that in a second. But You're on the road right now. Where are you? Like in Indiana?
I am in Indianapolis. Yeah. And I just found out, as a matter of fact, that President Donald Trump will be here tomorrow.
So let me ask you this. Now, maybe we should play some. Let's play your clips to set up this, because I don't know if people are familiar with your work. You've been on the program before, but you are somewhat political in your comedy. And I would put you to the left side of the spectrum in your comedy.
That would be fair.
Let's listen to at least this clip. And this is from your special. What's the special called again?
Senior Class of Earth.
Senior Class of Earth. And here is Ted Alexandro. And where was this? Where was the shot? In the
Comedy Cellar, Village Underground.
All right, here it is.
So it's the movements, everybody. It's the movements. We, the senior class of Earth, are tasked with doing what we can. You have to join the movement, see what's going on.
Wait, we lost sound. Sorry.
That's the gist of it, though. That's basically the gist
of it. That's it. That was the funny part, folks. And we had a technical problem. And are we about to resolve it? Hold on one second.
Just tease them, you know. That's what I say. Just give them enough that they're curious. Where's he going with this?
Right. You want them to want more. Here we go.
So it's the movements, everybody. It's the movements. We, the senior class of Earth, are tasked with doing what we can. You have to join the movement, see what's going on. Plug in, right? All the marches, the Women's March, the Climate March, the Science March. The scientists are marching. That's how bad it's gotten. They don't even like going outdoors. They have shit to research. They should be inside. They have to give up a Saturday because the president doesn't believe in climate science, thinks it's a hoax. You know the way those scientists are always trying to pull a fast one on us. Oh, you rapscallions. Fool me once and then prove it over and over and over again. Have it reviewed by your peers until it's a fact.
All right. Well, that's just a taste of it. But all right. So you're in Indianapolis. How does that go over there? Because Indianapolis is not necessarily, I would think, like your key demo.
Well, I mean, like every city, you're going to have a cross section of everything. But this particular weekend, I'm opening for Jim Gaffigan. So like I kind of split time between I do a lot of dates opening for Jim. So I'll do like 15 or 20 minutes at the start of the show. And then I do my own dates in comedy clubs, you know, where I kind of, it's more of a varied cross section of, you know, kind of doing my relationship stuff, doing political stuff. But when I open for Jim, like I am in Indianapolis, it's going to be more down the middle. Like I try not to polarize too much, like when I'm opening for him, because you know the crowd's there to see him, and it's a lot of families, and you know can be anything from 7-year-olds up to grandparents. They're not there. They didn't buy a ticket to see a political show, so I'll drop things in, but I try to be a little more selective when I'm opening for him.
Do you get a sense of like where, like, you know, even when you drop that stuff in, does it give you a sense of where the audience is and what might be changing? And so people should know with Gaffigan, and I actually saw him recently just by chance, you know, he's still doing more or less Hot Pocket stuff. I don't know if he's doing that on the road, but his stuff is, you know, largely about like what a goofball he is. And so people are going to see, there, you know, like this is about as like middle American as you can get, it seems to me. And I'm just curious, do you pick up like any changes in people's perspective or no, like politically?
Well, you know, what's interesting is I've been touring with Jim for a few years now. And before Trump got elected, like let's say during the election cycle, I could do stuff in front of Jim's crowds about Bernie, Hillary, Trump, and it would all kind of go over. But then there was this shift after Trump won where I guess people weren't, you know, like Trump supporters were no longer willing to be the butt of the joke. And not that I even target, you know, it's not like I just slam Trump, though, you know, that's not hard to do. But, you know, I try to write stuff that's funny and that hopefully, you know, anyone could kind of see the humor in. But I did notice this distinct shift that after he won, we would go to certain cities and like I couldn't even really mention his name. It would just be like, you know, it would be too much. It was more trouble than it's worth.
That's weird. Is that like, is that a function of like people feeling emboldened and sort of righteous because he won? Like we're right. We, you know, like what's behind?
Well, I think, you know what it was I think a lot of Trump voters were probably in the closet until he won. So I think there was this natural like release for them, especially in the, you know, the immediacy after he won, like, yeah, we don't have to hide anymore. You know, like, I'm not going to even let you start this joke about him. You know, there was more like, yeah, we've put up with this long enough. You know, I think it's kind of changed a bit now after a couple of years that, you know, I'm kind of strategic about when I do it, if I'm opening for Jim, but, you know, less so in my own sets. I just, you know, kind of say whatever I want.
And have you gone on to a lot of podcasts and on Twitter and complaining about how you can't go into these clubs anymore because of the political correctness of the Trump crowd?
No. I am.
What?
I don't feel particularly. Again, like if I'm doing my own show at a club.
But wait, Ted, don't you realize you're aggrieved because they're not laughing at your Trump jokes in these venues?
Yeah, no, that is that's a tough road for anyone. But, you know, as a comedian, it's up to me. You know, that's part of the job. Like, depending on where you are and what the job is, you know, because I could be doing a club gig that's my own date. I could be doing a corporate gig. I could be doing a college gig. So we constantly kind of assess as comedians, like, what is going to get me through this show? Is this more of an artistic endeavor where I'm, you know, really saying exactly what I want to say? Or is it a paycheck? Is it, you know, you're constantly assessing those things as a comedian. So yeah, I don't feel as though, I mean, like I perform at the Cellar in the city primarily when I'm home. And, you know, you get a cross section of people there too, because it's a lot of tourists. But yeah, I mean, you know, as a comedian, if you're going to stand behind your stuff, you do it no matter who's sitting there.
What is the senior class of Earth refer to? Is it, are we basically shutting it down after we're done?
This is it.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. We are the final graduating class of Earth. It seems more and more, it's just kind of an apocalyptic, reference, just that kind of impending sense of doom that we constantly deal with. So it's kind of dealing with that. But, it, you know, I would say that it's the album is probably half socio-political stuff. And I think it's also, you know, hopeful in some senses and, you know, as you have to be, right? You can't just kind of give in to the
doom. I mean, saying that we're the last class on Earth of people and then we're wrapping it up is, you know, it's like
you. But we did graduate. Let's not lose sight of that.
Well, that's true. But you're basically like setting up a. That's a tough joke to follow after that one. We're all going to die.
There is a measure of celebration. There's no jobs to be had, but we made it through.
Did you ever have a time where you would open with that we're all going to die and then realize, like, I got to put the relationship stuff first and then lead to that?
You know, I'm not that careful about what I open with because sometimes I almost like the challenge of opening with the darkest thing that almost digs a little bit of a hole.
Yeah.
So sometimes that's fun to go with the new thing or the dark thing. Because you know, you can get them back or, you know, if you have something that's more polished, you can always go to that. But yeah, I don't mind digging a little bit of a hole.
What, give me a sense of like, of how you think comedy has changed, you know, in the course of it, particularly as it relates to politics? Because, I mean, my sense, and I'm not involved in it, I mean, I'm barely involved in that world at all anymore, but my sense is that comedians have gotten far more political over the past, I don't know, 5 years or so.
Yeah, I would agree that, like, almost everyone has something political in their act now, whereas that, you know, that wasn't always the case, you know, certainly in the Obama years. So I think by virtue of Trump being elected, it was almost like you couldn't ignore just the spectacle of it. You have to, you know, you have to comment in some way. So I think anyone who was political maybe got that much more political, and anyone who wasn't, you know, at least has some stuff referring to it. But I also don't, I don't have this sense that, like, you know, you can't talk about this or that. I think what happens is it makes it a little more difficult, you know, like you kind of have to hit the target a little more dead center. And that goes for, like, with the PC police too, that people sometimes bemoan the fact that the PC police can't take a joke. I think, no, it's just that you have to be a better comedian. You, like, the lazy stuff that you used to get away with, or stuff that was outright offensive or misogynist or racist or what have you, is no longer being tolerated, and that's a good thing, you know. So I think a lot of this is actually ultimately to the betterment of comedy, if you're, you know, if you're progressing and trying to write better stuff.
Will you tell me a little bit about the Comedians Coalition? I know you were one of, like, the guys who were involved in starting that. What does that do?
Yeah.
What's happening?
Yeah, the New York Comedians Coalition was an organization that was started by myself and Russ Meneve, Tom Shalhoub, Buddy Bolton, a group of comedians, because for many years the pay for comedians in New York comedy clubs had remained the same essentially since, like, the mid-'80s. So we started this in, like, the early to mid 2000s, and we got over 300 comedians, everything from, you know, kind of the top regular working comics in the clubs, all the way down to kind of beginning open micers, just to kind of have the solidarity throughout the ranks. And we petitioned all of the clubs for a raise, and we wound up getting it raised. You know, spot pay on the weekends was like $50 since the 80s in the clubs. And we got that raised at that point to 75 to 85 was kind of the ceiling. And now it's up as high as, I think, 125. So, you know, it was successful in that, A, it initiated that dialogue that, you know, it kind of opened the channels between the comedians and the clubs. And it's been an ongoing thing. Certain clubs are a little better about kind of revisiting it. The Cellar is one of the better clubs. They kind of set the standard. But it kind of opened up that channel of dialogue, so it's been successful.
And did Tom Shalhoub begin to understand the value of solidarity and forming unions?
Well, that was so funny, because this was before Tom became like a Fox News contributor and all this stuff. Tom, at that point, was just another club comedian who I knew leaned to the right. But yeah, I didn't.
He always kept it very close to the vest back in those days, if I remember.
Literally vest too, because he was always wearing like a vest and a bow tie and stuff. But yeah, he didn't. Yeah, he did. He played it close to the vest, and you know, if you engaged in a political conversation with him, you could glean that he was right-leaning, but he's kind of leaned much further than I knew he was.
I don't know how somebody goes through that experience and then doesn't appreciate the value of, like, of unionization and solidarity when it literally has a material impact on you.
Well, yeah, I think Tom probably does realize that. I don't know. It's probably just one of those complicated things that couldn't really be cleared up in a soundbite, but yeah, I find Tom to be funny, interesting. We differ politically, and I probably haven't talked to him in, you know, probably like 4 or 5 years.
You don't have to justify it to me, Ted.
No, I'm not justifying. I find it just as intriguing as you do and as odd as you do.
I always tried to get him on to debate. When I realized he wouldn't do it, I stopped haranguing him. I was also, it was like a perfect, perfect opportunity to do that. But now, but Red Eye got canceled, didn't it? I never saw that show, but I was aware that he was hosting it, but it got canceled, I think, a long time ago, somebody told me. But
I don't know how long, yeah. It was on for a while, and a lot of comedians were doing it. But yeah, I never went on. I don't like to kind of...
Oh, no, you know, I would never go on, but he was hosting it for a while.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was his show for probably a couple of years.
Wow, I had no idea. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. Did not...
Yeah, but to his credit, he was one of the linchpins of, you know, our organization getting a raise for comedians.
So let me just ask you this about you had a piece that went a little bit viral in terms of Louis C.K. and
yeah.
I wouldn't say I'm a close friend, but I'm a friend of Louis. I see him maybe once or twice a year. And I'm curious at your perspective on this. Like the other day, Sarah Silverman came out, I guess, arguably in his defense on the Howard Stern show and said that he had consensually masturbated in front of her multiple times. Any more recent thoughts?
Well, I mean, most of what I thought about Louis and that situation is in the clip. You know, people can find that on YouTube. I did a set at the Cellar, and I actually did that set.
And I should tell people who aren't aware, the Cellar is where Louis has now done, I guess, two spots that he dropped in and did. He didn't address his situation, but he basically just tried out new material.
Yeah, yeah. So he returned to the Cellar, and then there was an article in the New York Times saying that he was back on a Tuesday, I believe, and I was at the Cellar that night, that Tuesday that the Times article came out, and I was just coincidentally happened to be there that whole week. So it was kind of on my mind, on a lot of comics' mind. It was in the news a lot that he had returned after 9 months of being away. And kind of just did a drop in and you know, went on stage. I spoke about it on stage and you know, like I said, the set kind of covers how I feel about it. You know, the main thing that I thought was that it wasn't being given the gravity that it deserved to kind of just show up to work unannounced and just do a drop in, you know, like I felt as though, you know, when the last thing he said was, I'm going to go away and I'm going to listen and I'm going to, you know, reflect on this, however he phrased it. And then to kind of just show up and bump other comedians, you know, and also I just felt as though it's like the Cellar.
Casual. I mean, the idea of it being casual when you come back.
Nothing's changed. Yeah.
Right.
That nothing's changed. I can still just show up unannounced and you know, like dictate the terms of my return. Like with there's, you know, to me, I found it curious that there's no discussion on the part of the club. The club just has the same policy. Like, yeah. Whenever you want to, you could have come back the day after, or you could have come back the week after. I certainly wasn't alone. Maybe I was alone in voicing it on stage or publicly, but in my conversations with comedians, there was a lot of kind of concern about him coming back like that, and also the club received a lot of heat for it. You know, the problem that I had too was that the people that were receiving heat were essentially everyone but Louis, you know, because he kind of just dropped in, dropped out, and then everyone else was left to kind of speak for him, you know.
That's the weird part. I mean, we should probably explain this a little bit because I think some of like the gaffes, like it is traditional at comedy clubs that people of Louis stature and not even, I mean, Louis had, you know, it's a fairly unique, you know, in the stratosphere. I mean, there's, you know, maybe maybe a half a dozen comedians who are, you know, in his sort of level. And there's, and even in comedians who are, you know, sort of like the next level below can stop in a comedy club at any time and basically get up in the next slot. Unless it's like a serious, you know, unless like the headliner's on, right? Like during the weekday, it's a free for all. And, mm-hmm. That happens all the time. You get, you know,
Yeah, the celebrity drop-in is kind of a standard. In fact, that's a big part of the Comedy Cellar's allure and their reputation is that you never know who's going to stop in at any moment.
And people literally never know. Like, it literally is, you know, it would have been, you know, pre his controversy. He could show up at any time and people would be, like, psyched that he's there.
Of course.
And so the comedy club, nobody at the comedy club, there had been no policy. Nobody anticipated that he wouldn't have had a more official return. And and I think that is like the part that I think people are just not aware of. They're debating whether or not it's fair for him to stay away or this and that. But it's also sort of like the mechanism, like, because there's a lot of people I would imagine at the door who are like, what are we supposed to do?
Like, that's exactly right. Yeah. I think it put a lot of people in kind of a difficult position where they had to make snap judgments. It really shouldn't be on the comedian who's emceeing that night or even the person who's managing the club that night. I think, you know,
in some way, it's tough to put it on the owner. It's even tough to put it on the owner in some way because of the nature of these of that relationship.
Well, I don't know that it is that tough. I mean, you know, it's part of owning a business and it's part of, you know, you have to make a lot of decisions, right?
Right.
So, yeah, so I think, you know, I'm friends with Noam and I voiced my concerns to him both in person and through email. And again, to his credit, you know, I go on the stage at the Cellar and I say whatever I want, which is again, why, you know, I think part of what made that clip, the dynamic of what made the clip interesting was that I was saying it on stage at the Cellar. So, you know, but I don't think you can paint it with one brush. And also, you know, the thing that I was saying in the clip is it was more of a macro discussion about the Me Too movement, about misogyny, patriarchy, powerful men acting without consequence. I talked about Cosby. I talked about Trump. And I talked about Louis because, unfortunately, he made himself part of that macro discussion.
Right. Well, folks can go to TedAlexandro.com and you can pay what you want, right? Is that what you're doing with the senior class?
No, not with this one. This one, my last two specials are Pay What You Want. They're on my website. This one I released through All Things Comedy, which is Bill Burr and Al Madrigal's company, a comedian-owned company. And to this point, they've been a podcast network. They have Bill Burr's podcast and I think for like 50 others. But this is the first special that they're distributing, and this is kind of their first foray into that terrain. So, yeah, you can get it at atcspecials.com, and there's an option to buy it. There's an option to stream it, but it's on atcspecials.com.
All right, Ted. And where are you performing? Where are you doing your stuff?
When I'm in New York, I'm at the Comedy Cellar. Primarily, you can see all my dates on TedAlexandro.com, and you'll also see the dates that I'm doing with Jim, and you'll see my own headline dates. But when I'm in New York, primarily at the Comedy Cellar.
All right, Ted. Thanks so much. I appreciate it, man.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sam.
All right. All right, folks. That is the free show for the day, ladies and gentlemen. We will now be heading into the fun half of the program, wherein we will hear more about the incredible dangers that the Republicans are speaking of that is amassing on our border. Well, wait a second. Let's talk about this. Do we have we know something about the MAGA bomber. Do we know anything more than what you sent me? This guy that is Cesar Sayoc.
It's MS-13.
And
it's in the name.
Apparently, this guy was busy on Twitter. Do we have the tweet?
Which one?
No, they took down his Twitter.
Oh, they took down his Twitter? Oh, we'll give it to Matt.
The ones that he sent to me.
Yeah, let's see that. So,
and Brendan too, right?
Yeah, Brendan's tagged in one of them.
Apparently, Brendan and Jamie were part of this guy's ire. His
some of these get a bit violent and graphic, by the way.
Yeah, we might not want to show the images.
So this guy on Twitter, his Twitter feed is down.
I don't want to scroll up too much because somebody was taking issue with she interpreted it as you defending Nancy Pelosi and whenever this was. And so Jamie was just explaining, like, it's not necessarily that you're defending Pelosi. It's that there's not a whole lot of options when it comes to replacing her, that sort of thing. Right.
And I said you were making a fairly narrower point than what she thought you were doing.
Yeah.
Wait, about me?
Yeah. It was like a pretty unrelated conversation about Nancy Pelosi.
And this guy just somehow found onto it, and he tweeted a bunch of different things at it. This is one of the least graphic ones, but it's basically implying that, like, gonna die in a swamp. It's sort of inscrutable. He's clearly kind of out there. And then he, like, the screenshots like that, right? Like, and here is one. I'll pull one of the more graphic ones over.
Well, one of them, he said, "We have a real special airboat tour lined up for you. See you real soon."
Oy.
And, don't show that. Oy, Jesus gosh. Christ.
What a lunatic.
Yeah. But my favorite one that he said to me, I mean, not favorite because they're all horrible, but he said, in response to the same thread, "Antifa, you're next." And he spelled it Y-O-U-R. As if it's not bad enough that I'm being threatened by a crazy person on Twitter, he's also going to butcher the English language.
And he includes, like, pictures of somebody that, like, looks like he got bitten to death by a snake or something. It's really...
So what... And did you remember this? Like, did you remember getting this stuff? Or was it just...
It filtered out?
Actually, there was a screenshot of one of his tweets to me at the header of the Daily Beast article on him.
Oh, well, that's
and I was
fun.
Like, oh, that's good to know, I guess. Because, like, I get tweeted at constantly by crazy people who think I'm, like, the president of Antifa or whatever. So, yeah.
There you go. Well, I mean, you shouldn't put in your bio as president of the Antifa. I mean, that is the CEO.
I will
Antifa.
Say I have
chief executive officer.
I have scaled back my trolling of replies and, like, the MAGA people because I don't want any of this static.
Yeah,
like,
because they're insane, deeply
and it's a stochastic thing, right? Like remember that? I mean, we all forget already, but that newsroom that was shot up like a few months ago, and then everyone's like, "Well, this person had a long running grudge with the newsroom. You can't really blame it on Trump." It doesn't matter. Trump's rhetoric is increasing the pressure for this sort of stuff. So, like, anybody who has a grievance with the newsroom, and this guy, I mean, very explicitly on the MAGA train, but, like, they feel actionized to do it.
Not for nothing. You guys probably don't remember this, but there was a guy in Denver named Alan Berg who was a left-wing radio show host who was killed. Who was it that killed him? No, it was, yeah, it was like one, like a, I don't know, so, like a prototype of a sovereign citizen type of person. So, you know, there's, it's not without precedent to have some concern. And, you know, we try and maintain some security around here. And, it's about all. Krav Maga and up right now. So, all right, we got to take a break. Oh, I should also say, folks, unrelated, that Ted Alexandro's special was directed by none other than Matthew Film Guy. And I was remiss in not saying that. And I apologize. So,
think of all the eBay traffic you just cost him.
I cost him a lot of eBay traffic. Do we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake guy today?
Ask the moms? That's just a Kavanaugh drop.
Michael's doing his own Kavanaugh drops.
It felt appropriate for
what,
some
do we have
reason.
A Jimmy Reef here?
Oh, okay. Do we really need to?
Just
have,
a
I
reminder.
I thought we were taking a break from Jimmy Reefer Cake.
Just a reminder.
After his anti-Semitic screed on Twitter.
What?
Some people.
Jimmy Reefer Cake had a
apparently he had a meltdown last week.
A week ago.
Like he had like a hippie MAGA Obama style meltdown.
I believe he sort of asked like to bridge a divide between somebody on Twitter. He said he liked Indian food.
No, I forget. Wait, it was what? Something. It was something right. like.
It was
something
bad.
Like Western. Are bad, particularly Judaism, which you know, yeah, which I mean, I happen to agree with, but I'm just kidding.
Well, it looks like this might have addressed it. This one's called
whatever. He's just a pain in the ass.
Well,
this song's called "Be Your Own Religion."
We'll play it in
Dude,
a second.
Do better for weed.
All right, hold on for one second.
You're hurting the brand.
Let
me just say,
the weed community,
folks. This show exists because of your support. You can support this program by becoming a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you go to jointhemajorityreport.com and you spend the pennies a day to support this programming, you are not only supporting this show, this free show, but we give you extra content every day. So jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Friday. Other days are not Friday. Some of those are Tuesdays. And on Tuesday, it's the Michael Brooks Show. Michael, I know what you're going to be talking about next Tuesday.
What is that?
Well, the Brazilian race.
Well, we did a Tuesday was the lead up to the Brazilian race. So we'll probably touch on some of that on Tuesday. Guests are Big Waz. And we are talking about NBA and some other sports related stuff. Then Harvey Kay is back in studio. We're talking about Thomas Paine and the Democratic Party.
Does he live in New York?
No, he lives in Wisconsin.
And what, is he just visiting New York a lot?
He has family here.
Okay.
And then I will, and then on Sunday, the illicit history that's coming out for patrons is with Julian Brave Noise Cat, who's an indigenous peoples activist and policy analyst at 350.org. And we talked about different conceptions of property in indigenous traditions and the policy implications for eco rights in places ranging from New Zealand to India. And it's a fascinating conversation. I'd also check out. I'll mention the YouTube channel this time again because it's sort of ramping up as well. Patreon.com/TMBS.
And Jamie?
On this week's episode of The Antifada, we talked to Sham Khanna, editor-in-chief of an exciting new magazine called Commune, about the project of leftist political ed and what niche they hope to fill. Then we talked to Commune contributor Andy Battle about the political economy of mass transit and why the New York City subways are falling apart. From there, we branch out into a deep dive on the movement of people and things and how transportation infrastructure is really overdetermined right now by the necessities of capital accumulation. And we always like to end on a call to action. So lastly, we try to envision what transportation would look like if it were designed for human needs instead of exchange value, and what kind of direct action tactics we're going to need to move us closer to that goal. And we just released a bonus episode this morning for all of our patrons, where we flesh out some of these utopian visions for the future of transit, including socialist planning, mutual aid, and using Jurassic Park-style super science to implement an overcoming of Guy Debord's conception of pseudo-cyclical time under capitalism.
And it's that type of left populism that would have gotten the MAGA bomber to support Bernie if Hillary Clinton had embraced those policies.
I like it when Guy Debord gets it on the chin, though.
I literally just got threatened by this guy.
Oh, no, it was months ago. He's been arrested, though.
Oh, okay.
It's okay.
We should say, I initially referred to him as Cesar Sayak, but I guess that is his nickname. He also goes, Cesar Altieri Sayak. Okay, go ahead.
MS-13. MS-13.
And Matt, on Literary Hangover?
Yep, Literary Hangover. Pequot War. I'm going to put the YouTube video out. It's a history of it, so if you don't like fiction, you don't need to feel like I'm alienating you. It's just a straight history of the Pequot War and Mystic Massacre, so check it out.
There you go. We got to take a quick break. head into the fun half of the program right after we play this Jimmy Dore song entitled...
Yeah, well, it looks like he has a new collaborator called 10 Foot Man, and
I'm sorry, Jimmy Reaverkick. Oh, geez. I wasn't paying attention.
Wait, what? I thought that was on purpose.
No, that was not on purpose.
I was giving you more credit.
What did I miss?
He said, we have a Jimmy Dore song.
Jimmy Reaverkick. Sorry, folks. I was still reading about... Sayak. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, it's called Your Own Religion.
Your Own Religion. Jimmy Reaverkick.
U.S. should allow the killing of children and civilians just because they want to melt that cow. Suck it on the teeth of the Saudi Arabian army fleet. Their army is complete because they buy that crap from us. We run our economy by sacrificing souls. Then maybe our leaders need to be smoking a big fat bowl of truth from outer space, cause that's the place where the freshest taste. I'm growing that strain up here in Maine. Learn to make clothes, you can grow your own. Oh Lord. Your own religion. J.D. Peckism, Matlickism, Sam Cedarism, Brooksyism, Brainstomperism, Brandon Finnism, your own ism. We are gathered here before outer space and all of the universe to pledge our love for all mankind, whether it be two-legged, three-legged, or ten-legged.
The infinite wisdom of a religion is rocking to the rhythm of a ten-foot man. Jamie Peck preaching to the DSA. Peckism believes there's a better way. Ism, a rocket ship to automated gay space luxury communism. But Cedarism's got a lot of fame talking about that zero-sum game. Reaper Cakeism says give them what they need, much less war and much more weed. And it says no human sacrifices, just let the humans have their vices. If Jesus was the Prince of Peace, then why is peace always out of reach? Come together with our nation, prevent the end of civilization. I bring you nuggets of truth from outer space. Outside your bubble is a special place. Infinite space and stars, there's lots of them. The other troubles, the lack of oxygen. So take care of this earth, the sick and the poor. It's a religion, and it can be yours.
Your own religion.
There you go. It's very expansive.
The only thing that I like about Jimmy Reaverkick is that it's an insult to the audience that we play him.
Entering Pink Floyd runtime.
People in check.
It's a very expansive sound for Jimmy Reaverkick. All right, quick break. Head into the fun half.